This is Michaela J., the voice of the corporation, and you're listening to SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Listen, this is no set of rules. I'm not telling you what to do. All I'm saying is I'm bringing up three things that are, like, so important to the whole world. I don't have to find much importance in. Because of these things, whether they're fucking or whether they're playing golf, because of that, I feel
if you guys don't mind, I'd like to sort of flip this conversation. So we've been talking about the idea of the intentional, of where can people try and control these events. But you don't seem to shy away from, whereas a fundamentalist might, you're not shying away from the weirder nature of these events, and that there are certainly, as events play out, whether it's something being activated in our DNA or something even stranger, that events will kind of take on a life of their own. You know, you've mentioned Esalen and your recent posts on Star Trek. So here we kind of have the idea of someone who obviously knows what they're writing about is making very intentional references. And then there's this other thing that seems to come in where they couldn't have known certain things, or synchronicity or the unconscious or something else comes in. Can you speak to some of that?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I'd been to Esalen in 2008 and 2009. And I just like, boy, I'll tell you something, because I've been reading all these conspiracy theories about Esalen for years, and I just was like,
I'm going there in a week. Just jump in.
There you go. I mean, you'll see. I mean, it's a gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful place. But I mean, I'm not into that scene. You know, I mean, I'm very East Coast. I'm really not very crunchy. You know, it's just not my scene. But you know, there is an agenda at work there, and the agenda is the Rockefellers wanted to take the teeth out of the New Age. They wanted to make sure that the New Age was not threatening to any of their interests, that the New Age was bland, unthreatening, apolitical, and that's exactly what happened. And Lawrence Rockefeller basically used Esalen to build an empire for himself, you know, including the noetic sciences. He funded that in part. I don't think he's I don't know how heavily involved he was, but the California Institute of Integral Studies is definitely his, and there's a few others. And for me, you know, somebody who sort of got a sense of the New Age just before the whole Shirley MacLaine, which I call the Shirley MacLaine disinfo campaign, kicked in the mid 80s, you know, it was definitely dangerous. It was more occult. It was more countercultural. It was, you know, it was more rough and ready. It was more pagan. You know, it was just a lot more interesting. It was sharper.
You're like describing the Sicarii becoming like the gospel Christians.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, you know, New Age, it took a while for me to sort of adjust to, like, but I didn't realize at the time that there was this very deliberate agenda being put into place by people with a lot of money to co-opt this movement. You know, and Esalen, before Dick Price died, you know, you had people like John Lilly and Timothy Leary and Terrence McKenna and Alan Watt, and over and over and over, just, you know, all these interesting, edgy kind of people there. And afterwards, it became people like Deepak Chopra and Gene Houston, and
that's so fucking sad, man.
And Al Gore.
Yeah, exactly. And Al Gore, and you know, there really is. I mean, Mike Murphy has done some interesting work, but you know, he definitely likes power. He was very close friends with Lawrence Rockefeller. He was very much involved in that whole Russian program, you know, which for the Russians was a disaster, with Boris Yeltsin and things like that, and the the selling off of the oil rights and everything, you know, which was a huge boost to the Rockefellers, but basically impoverished Russia
Russia didn't want anything that they were offered. That's another problem with Gorbachev. So, but that's another.
Well, you know, it's very interesting though, because I think it started well. I think Michael Murphy meant well. I think that he was very interested because there was a lot of interesting work, esoteric work being done in Russia, even under the Soviets. Yeah, I think that the Soviets, the Russians have a very mystical mind. And Jacques Vallée said, you know, in one of his books, he was over there and he was talking to a Russian general who was also running one of the psychic research programs. And he said, you know, in Russia, we didn't burn our witches. He said, that's why you in the West are so far behind, because you burnt all your witches. Whenever somebody showed up with any kind of power, you burnt them at the stake. And I thought that was such a great
quote. I was just referring to when people were offered shares. They were given shares and they didn't want them. And that's just really because they're so used. It's there's a comfort in the familiar, I guess, or something. But yeah, people just didn't really want freedom.
I think we're having two parallel conversations here. But anyway,
we are. I'm sorry, Paul.
No, it's okay. But anyway,
Take it back to the idea of not burning the witches. So I guess what I'm saying is that there is. We have the very intentional funding and manipulation of these communities, and yet it seems that these communities somehow, there's either an echo of the true sense of these the higher weirdness, it's either an echo of it or something that bleeds through. But in all these, you were writing about how Star Trek, the specific returning to the idea of it being a parallel of Esalen. And yet there were things that no one could have known about, or that perhaps a higher strangeness bled through into the whole roller coaster ride of Esalen and the media that was based on it.
Well, this is where I sort of got into this guy named Leslie Stevens. Leslie Stevens was the creator of The Outer Limits, but he was also the son of one of the most powerful military men of the 20th century. And, you know, basically Gene Roddenberry, who, you know, created a thing that he called Star Trek that really didn't have a lot to do with what became what we know as Star Trek. Leslie Stevens had a lot to do with that. But what happened is that there was this civil war going on in the higher echelons of the establishment, and it was alluded to in an episode of The Outer Limits after Leslie Stevens was forced out. They did an episode based on the Harvard Psychedelic Club. Now, Star Trek to me, a very negative, you know, where a Timothy Leary figure is depicted in a very negative light. And also an episode that the film Altered States, you know, basically was inspired by. But anyway, I just need to backtrack. I need to offer a little bit of context here. Star Trek was really part of an agenda that came in with Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had John F. Kennedy knocked off and took power, because there was a very big push to create, you know, a new system that he called the Great Society, which was massive social engineering at home and militarization abroad. And Star Trek, I think, was very much part of that. And The Outer Limits was not. The Outer Limits was more Eastern establishment, you know, more eccentric, more mystical. But at the same time, because the DNA of Star Trek was so infused with people like Leslie Stevens, and also one of the an Esalen trustee named Jeremy Tarcher also wrote a very interesting episode of Star Trek. You know, it changed the course of the program. I think that Gene Roddenberry had his druthers. That show would have been very militaristic, you know, muscular liberalism, you know, neoliberalism, forcible, colonization, you know, a very you know, the Johnson agenda in space, but it changed because of the presence of a very esoteric thinker named Leslie Stevens, a very strange and interesting guy. So what I'm trying to say is that when you talk about things like intent and symbolism and unintentional things, it becomes a very gray area. Because once you put these things in motion, the symbols begin to tell their own stories. The symbols activate parts of our brain that we don't know are being activated. You know, I can always tell when intentional symbolism is being unrolled. It's because usually the person who is unrolling it in front of you wants you to know that it's saying, oh, look at how clever I am.
Yeah. You know? Trying to be as overt as possible. The best place to hide something's in plain sight, too. So people know that they see it, yet they don't want to know that they see it a lot of the time, depending.
You know, but, you know, there's a sort of a cheesy sort of aspect of this that we see in a lot of Hollywood movies, that it's like hint, hint, wink, wink. There was a really terrible movie, I forget what it was called, Stigmata, with one of the, what's her name? The girl who played that in that show Medium. She was also,
is that Patricia Arquette?
Patricia Arquette, yeah. She played a stigmata, and there was this whole subplot with the Gospel of Thomas, and it was so just painfully obvious and just so in your face. And that's always been sort of my touchstone for like bad intentional symbolism. And it's embarrassing. And to me, I like it when either somebody like a Grant Morrison or an Alan Moore, where you know where they're coming from, you know what I mean? But, you mm-hmm. know, even those guys, you know that they're putting the stuff in there, and they want you to know that they're putting the stuff in there. You know, it's part of an agreement that you have when you enter into this work. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of stuff where it's like the symbolism just sort of creeps in because the artist is playing with themes and dives, you know, finds himself being pulled under, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know,
like, it does.
The intentional symbolism stuff just bores me to tears. But again, let's remember, let's backtrack a bit here and just remember that most of the people who are sort of looking at the symbolism and saying, oh, look at this, isn't this terrible, are either fundamentalist Christians or neo-Nazis. So they're going to say, oh, look at this, oh, you know, we're being brainwashed. And it doesn't make any damn sense, you know. It's like, oh, we're being mind controlled by the symbolism. How? How are you being mind controlled by this? You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's just their entire interpretation of the symbolism is based in people like Tex Mars and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. It's just, it's all insanity. And it's all based in that whole fear hysteria, because they're still addicted to the adrenaline rush that you get from that fear hysteria. And I'm not, you know, listen, that's a very powerful drug. You know, that whole fear response triggers a lot of very powerful chemicals in the brain, and that's what they're addicted to. But that stuff doesn't really interest me. I mean, at this point in the game, I mean, like everyone else, I was interested in that stuff maybe 20 years ago, but it's not interesting to me anymore. The stuff that interests me now, the stuff that I want to follow because it you know, it's constructive, it works, it leads you places, is the stuff when the symbols, somebody might be sort of playing with a symbol. Somebody might be making an allegory. You know, it's all very sort of nebulous, but the symbols take over. They tell their own story because the symbols are part of a program. Symbols are part of a program, you know, on several different levels in our conscious mind, in our unconscious mind, and in our DNA, and in our culture. You know, it's several different levels. You know, it's
but
like
are the symbols. Are they transcendent of who's projecting them now or who's been projecting them through the whole span? Like, because that's something that I'm never completely clear on ultimately, is because if you're dealing with something that's archetypal enough, then the nodes that lie behind the archetype might be transcendent of any appearance that they're being portrayed as. Does that make sense?
Well, I see. You got to understand that, you know, they've accumulated so much experience over thousands of years, so many different stories, you know what I'm saying? And things that we might not necessarily consciously know. you know, basically what I'm trying to say is that, like, conscious use of symbolism, unless it's done really well by a person like an Alan Moore, really bores me.
And even Alan Moore at times stumbles through it.
Yeah.
I mean, but even beyond pop culture and what we're talking about, like, with films and music and all of this stuff, but, like, what do you think of, like, transpersonal psychology, where a lot of the same archetypes will arise so spontaneously with no explanation that it seems like it's so rooted in the psyche, even beyond, like, what people have... Have you seen some of the things that have come out of transpersonal psychology?
That's where I'm coming from, but I take it a step deeper. I go from, you know, I take it from a transpersonal psychological standpoint, but I take it, you know, a deeper level that these are also triggers that trigger something in our DNA that we don't quite understand. You know, this there's a deeper level that goes beyond, you know, even the collective unconscious. And I think that that's sort of the next phase is trying to understand, you know, the genetic aspect of this.
Dig it, yeah.
Chris, you know, there's a question I've always wanted to ask you, because one of the things I admire is that you're not you're really kind of showing that there is both, that there is a human intent, you know, whether we want to call that conspiracy or manipulation or just conscious use of symbolism, and there's also the high strangeness that comes in. But you're also very well versed in the mystery schools. What I want to get at is, you had written years back about a mystery school that kind of kept some of these narratives alive, and you referred specifically the fact that we're constantly bombarded with serious symbolism and the 17 enigma, such as, like, a news story might show 17 people died on a bus. You know, a bus crash, and then that number gets changed, invariably, almost always gets changed to something else.
Yes.
So is this speaking to an intentional ritual?
Absolutely. I believe so. And one thing you'll notice when you read the blog is that when I take sort of a mocking tone, that's what I'm writing about, the intentional symbolism, because, you know, it just becomes so obvious that I just sort of make fun of it, because I don't want to feel... I don't understand exactly what their intention is. I'm not privy to where they're going with this. So I don't want to feel like I'm an accomplice. Because
right.
One thing that people like, you know, whoever is running Vigilant Citizen, and I've heard, you know, a number of different theories on who exactly is behind that. But basically what they are is they're accomplices. And all those people are, they're saying, oh, look, isn't this horrible? Well, that's exactly what the people who are putting that symbolism want you to say.
Right.
They want you to be outraged, because that's part of the game. And I've written about this over and over again, and people just don't get it.
Seems obvious enough, right?
I've become extremely impatient, you know, particularly over the past year, because I just get tired of saying the same thing over and over again. It's, you know, when you look at that kind of stuff, first of all, it's so dumb. It's so simplistic. It's the same five or six things over and over again. And if you are saying, oh, look at this, isn't this terrible? You're basically an accomplice to somebody else's viral marketing scheme. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that. I don't care it's going to get me 40,000 hits a day, because it's boring to me. You know, it's not interesting. It's dull.
But what about the... cosmic viral marketing of, you know, the artists who really are tapping into something transcendent.
I want to get back to the whole serious and some
perfect. Thank you.
Because, you know, I'm not done with that. That stuff, you know, basically what that showed me is, and this is why I'm never surprised by how just awful Obama is. Is that basically what that showed, what Obama was saying symbolically to whoever was paying attention to those symbols, was like, we are exactly the same. McCain and I are mirror images of each other. That's why they took the symbolism, you know, and who knows what serious means to them. This is what people don't understand, is that symbols have different meanings to different people. They might mean different things, to, you know, Sirius might have an entirely different meaning to people in Washington than it does to, you know, certainly to people in Egypt. You know, don't ever assume that these symbols mean the same thing. You know, when I see the symbols on, you know, like in these music videos, I just go, I'm almost positive that all these symbols are being used by people in the gay community as in jokes. You know what I'm saying? I'm certain, because all the symbolism is being put in by designers and video directors and fashion people, fashion photographers. You know, it's obvious that all that, you know, what was occult symbolism is probably all anal sex jokes. You know what I mean? And people are putting it out there like, oh, isn't this terrible? They're, you know, Illuminati witches coming to kill us all, when it's probably just all, you know, butt sex jokes, you know, between all these different designers. So don't ever assume that symbols have the same meaning to different people, because they don't. I mean, we know this for a fact. But the serious symbolism, what Obama was saying, and he was probably saying this to different people in different secret societies who don't have direct contact with him, is that I'm one of you. I'm with your program. You know, we don't have direct contact, but don't worry. I'm going to take care of you.
Nods as good as a wink.
That's exactly what he was saying. He's saying, I'm going to give you what you need. I'm not going to raise taxes on you. I'm not going to close down your tax shelters. You know, I'm not going to cut down on military spending. That's what I think that's what really was all about. And that's what I see in hindsight. And I sort of, you know, I didn't know that at the time, but I see that all now, that he was just saying, I'm one of you, because somehow this symbolism has some sort of meaning to them. And it's probably all Masonic.
Oh, it's definitely Masonic, yeah.
You know, I mean, there are these Masonic groups that aren't free. This is one thing that people need to understand. There are all these Masonic groups that aren't Freemasons. You know, Phi Beta Kappa is one of these groups.
Luce's Trust is huge with the UN and the...
No, stop.
What's that?
I've Luce's Trust is a joke. I've been to to a Luce's Trust meeting. It was a bunch of little old ladies nodding off. I mean,
no, I'm talking about the United Nations headquarters.
No, stop.
No, don't
pay attention. That's that Luce's Trust is just a joke. It's basically, who was it? Constance Cumby. This is where it all came from. Constance Cumby was writing all these New Age exposés, quote unquote, and was just searching around for groups to attack. And that's, you know, people just cut and paste and see this stuff cut and pasted. But it all came from this really crazy woman in Michigan. Luce's Trust is a joke. I've been there.
You don't think it has anything to do with Alice Bailey being an offshoot of the Theosophical Society? Do you feel that the Theosophical Society is a joke?
No, I think that those groups were created by Masonic groups, you know, and then close down. I think that those groups were created for particular.
Okay. Purposes. Okay. So this is something.
If you look at the people who were at the sort of upper echelon of the Theosophical Society and the Luce's Trust, they were basically shell corporations or front groups.
I'm not saying they're not a joke, but at the same time, you know, when it was first proposed that the initial website, the first website that went up for the Occupy movement, was traced to the UN plaza, specifically from the Luce's Trust, I didn't believe it. I had to do quite a bit of cross-referencing to actually be sure that was the case, and indeed it was. And the fact that they were the initiator, one of the main initiators that got whatever the fuck that was rolling, is a point of real interest to me, whether they're a joke or not. I mean,
I tell you what I think that was about? I think that they were trying to ride a wave. I think that they are basically a spent force. If, you know, go to one of their meetings, if you don't believe me.
Well, one of their small... They're smaller. Yeah, I mean, I imagine if you ask.
I left screaming in the middle, because I'd never been so bored in my life. I mean, it was literally an old lady knitting circle.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the BOTA is. That's what a lot of these things actually are. They're like fucking knitting circles. And actually, Masonry is like a fucking knitting circle. You know how boring the fucking those lodge meetings are? I mean,
yeah,
that's like...
I know, exactly. But, like, the real groups, this is what I'm saying, the real groups are like the college fraternities, you know, especially like at Yale and Harvard and, you know, groups like, you know, the Phi Beta Kappa and... You know, that's where the things get done. You know, you can't just walk in off the street and join the elites. That's what people don't understand. And I really believe that a lot of the sort of occult conspiracy stuff, you know, is people who secretly want to believe that they can somehow join, you know, that they can just walk in and become a Freemason and become, you know, a world ruler. It doesn't work that way. You know, I think that the real ruling class, you know, they choose you.
Did you ever read Proofs of a Conspiracy from the 1700s, late 1700s, about Masonry, about the Illuminati, the first published...
Oh, like Robinson? See, but, the, yeah, but, you know, it's interesting, because I have a friend who's a Mason, and we've been corresponding, and he said, you know, he talks about how, like, all the Masons are, like, all despondent, and he's very philosophic about it. He said, you know, the purpose of Masonry was to separate church and state, depose the kings of Europe and create public education. You know, he said that was the purpose of the Freemasons. And that's why they were pretty radical in the 1700s. Because and they
would you not agree that that's also why they get attacked so much within, like, what it blows my mind time after time is that all these wannabe patriotic liberty movements and stuff like that attack Freemasonry and the quote unquote Illuminati when these are the groups that say they want to be out from government oppression, which is basically
they attack groups that don't fight back. That's why.
But I guess I'm saying, you know,
If you want to be blustery, you create an imaginary group like the Illuminati that can't come to your house and shoot you in the forehead or
right.
You know what I'm saying? It's all.
But I guess I'm comparing it in the same way that a fundamentalist Christian attacks, you know, occult symbolism in Harry Potter as if they actually have power, whereas they don't believe their priests have any real connection to God. In much the same way, I feel like attacking a group that is who actually may have tried to overthrow monarchs and oppressive governments, while at the same time pissing your pants over every little. You know, instead of actually taking on the injustices of a rising police state here in the United States, you attack some centuries-old institution that tried to do the same damn thing.
Yeah, well, that's because these people are cowards.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the reason I brought up that book was because I just wanted to point out the aspect that's emphasized in that book of the idea of infiltration and how you have very sharp people in the midst of a lot of dull people. Most of the people involved in Freemasonry, if you notice, are very dull. And a lot of people don't even read Albert Pike. And it's not like if they did, they would have any like deeper understanding, because it's not just about reading a bunch of information, but like the participation side of it energetically, which would require a bit of empathy, which very few people seem to have. But that's another talk. But I just the idea of infiltration of organizations that have their own kind of like limited motive, and then there's people with a deeper motive in the midst of those. What do you think of that?
Well, I think where that comes from, you know, is not necessarily, you know, Masonic. It's the ruling class, you know. It's people like the Freemasons and everything like that, they're just tools. When you really look at who the Freemasons were, they were the servant class. And originally, you know, they were free.
Sure.
Because they had this very elaborate secretive system, they became useful to, you know, this group of firebrands who had a political program that they wanted to put in place. I just don't pay attention to that stuff anymore, you know, as far as Masonic and all that kind of stuff, because it's really not relevant, you know, when you see that what is going on is so out in the open now. You know, I mean, we don't need to speculate anymore about, you know, where our problems are coming from. I mean, they're out in the open now.
Yeah, you've made the point that you know, you look at, say, a post 9/11 propaganda, it was very in your face. Hey, we need to go kill a bunch of brown people. Torture's cool. Be a patriotic American. It was very, very in your face. And that's why you didn't find – you're not really afraid of this quote-unquote MK Ultra, you know, Illuminati symbolism and stuff like that. Can you just – if you don't mind, just speak to that for another moment of the difference between real propaganda being in your face and all this other stuff being a much grayer subject.
Well, I think a lot of this stuff is being put out there as a distraction. You know, it's basically being put out there because, you know, somebody will have this free-floating anxiety. And if they channel that towards a group that's going to, like, basically want to tax the banks or, you know, cut the military budget, they're going to become a threat. But if you point them towards a group that's going to worry about, you know, some model covering her eye in a fashion spread, you know, yeah, then they become completely disempowered and marginalized. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
It's put out there as an intentional distraction. There's no question in my mind. There's no question in my mind that all this stuff is coming that was popularized. You know, see, this is the thing, is that people think that everything comes from the top down, and that's not really what the way it works. Things sort of float in this soup, and the people at the top say, oh, we can use that. So people saw, you know, that guy, Ben Single, was it Singleton?
Oh, the pseudo-occult media guy?
Yeah, pseudo-occult media, and saw him and said, hey, we can use that to, you know, mostly poor black and Hispanic people so they don't worry about, you know, not being paid a living wage and you know, just payday loans and all these things that they're getting screwed left and right. You know, we'll just give them, you know, they can just worry about Jay-Z and Beyonce being Illuminati witches, and we can just give them this whole... You know, it's a perfect thing. You know, it's a perfect formula because it gives them this glamorous pseudo reality to be afraid of. You know, but there's always this nod and wink that it isn't real, but they can pretend it's real, and they can sort of project all their real world anxieties and fears onto it. And you know, the people at the top don't worry about them, you know, going on strike or you know, causing a riot or whatever. You know, all, when you really look at it, all this material, you know, particularly with the things like pseudo-occult media and Vigilant Citizen, they're all directed at the poor and working class, you know, of all different races and religious backgrounds. You have people who are Christians, you have people who are Muslims, you have people who are white, people who are black. But I think the common denominator for the market, for that audience, is that these people are not very well educated, usually not very high income, and could be trouble if they started worrying about not getting a living wage, not having access to health care, you know, paying exorbitant rents, having exorbitant travel times for the commutes. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, hell yeah.
It gives them a phony outlet for their real world anxieties. It's the same thing where you sit there and you pretend that all these people who are dead, you know, this grand conspiracy, this grand mind control conspiracy of all these people who are dead, who can't come after you, who can't sue you. You know what I mean? Like, if you were really some great patriot or great, you know, champion of the people, you wouldn't go after, you wouldn't be worrying about people like Alice Bailey or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wouldn't even be worried about MK Ultra. You'd be worried about things that are happening now. You'd be worried about problems that people are having now, because the pressing issues that people are having now need to be solved now. Do you understand what I'm saying? You
would right.
What Albert and wasn't or whatever nonsense.
Wasn't it interesting that Columbine was simultaneous with the hearings on MK Ultra? So when they finally had like a hearing for the crazy shit that those people, the CIA participants, took part in, it happened to coincide with the Columbine shootings, which meant that it got absolutely no press coverage whatsoever, if it would have in the first place. But people weren't even aware that was going on. I found that kind of interesting.
Well, you know what else is interesting? And this is something that a lot of people who are serious conspiracy researchers at the time noticed, is the whole thing with Monarch. That Monarch sort of, you know, came out of nowhere at the when MKUltra was coming to light too. And, you know,
Monarch, I don't know how true any of that is. That's like, well, one no, Monarch, person's account.
Monarch, I don't believe a word of Monarch. I think it's total nonsense. And if you... There's a great book by Jim Keith, the late Jim Keith, on I forget what it's called, but he did a great book on mind control where he basically took it apart bit by bit. And, you know, I mean, the guy who co-wrote that book, quote unquote, was a CIA agent, you know. So, and no, people just, but people want to believe an exciting, people want to believe an exciting story with celebrities in it rather than the depressing, miserable reality of human experimentation, you know.
Sure.
But what about, if you don't mind, I really want, I don't know how long you're able to stay with us, Chris. So it's
not
a reason.
Much longer.
Yeah, exactly. That's why.
42 minutes.
Yeah. This is why I kind of want to keep pushing it in this direction, because this is a subject I really want to touch on with you, is the idea of what is real then. So there's like not the conspiracy stuff, but I mean, when we talk about the psychedelic or
the, real.
I don't mean to dismiss that. What I'm saying is the conspiracy of an esoteric agenda and all this sort of stuff. What I'm getting at, though, is that there is a true connection to something that often comes through art. That, you know, we can say, you know, Lady Gaga is just whatever. But whether it's using symbolism or, as you and I both prefer, not necessarily intentionally using symbolism, but tapping into something. The way in, you know, a Jack Kirby or an Alex Nino or any of these guys who might... Maybe they've taken psychedelics, maybe they haven't. Maybe they're just naturally attuned to something. But tuning into this higher weirdness that comes through art is that we are able to tap into something that is also very real.
Well, that's what interests me, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I want to. That's what I want to spend the rest of this talk with.
You know, I've been focused on is that, you know, people who try to worry about things that are outside their own sphere of influence are wasting their lives. You know. It always makes me laugh, and it's like, oh, we really get them on the run. Yeah, we're sitting there taking their bait, you know, basically what they're saying. Yeah, the examples of people like of Jack Kirby, because really, you know, I have a very practical sense, you know, it's like, what can I do to make my life better? What can I do to make my life more enriching, more interesting, more fulfilling? You know, what interests me? What excites me? What can I share with people that can raise their consciousness, like in a literal sense, not in this sort of nebulous, touchy-feely sense, but can literally expand their consciousness, you know, can literally change the way they look at the world. And that's really what I'm interested in. And, you know, one of the reasons why I spend so much time looking at Jack Kirby is that, you know, here's a guy who had a very traumatic childhood. It was either rubella, I think it was rubella, you know, at a time when there were no antibiotics, and very interesting story. You know, he had this disease that probably would have killed most of the people in the neighborhood because he grew up on the Lower East Side. He was very poor and his family were desperate. So they called in a bunch of Kabbalist rabbis and they sit there and they exorcised him. They basically said he's possessed by demons and we're going to exorcise the demons. And you think, well, Jesus, that's like out of the Stone Age, right? But it worked, you know? So that's one of the first interesting thing. And then, you know, he grew up in a lot of violence, inter-ethnic violence. And he went from that environment to being a foot soldier in World War II. And when, you know, his... CEO found out that he could draw, said, okay, you're going to do reconnaissance, go behind enemy lines and sketch out what's going on over there and come back. You know, basically the most deadly, dangerous job in the army. And he actually got captured. I just recently found this out. He had gotten captured and had to fight for his life to get out. And then he got sent home with, with Frostbite. So I really, and then, you know, he's always very talented, you know, always a very, you know, one of the top creators in the field. But then sometime in the early 60s, his work just becomes completely psychedelic. And I really, truly believe, and I'm just going to add the caveat, but this is my opinion, that I believe that he was treated for post-traumatic stress with some sort of psychedelics. I think that, you know, he had such an incredibly traumatic childhood and war experience. I mean, I can't possibly imagine a more traumatic war experience than what he experienced. I mean, a Jewish guy being captured by the Nazis, can you imagine anything worse? And then having to fight his, you know, his way out. I just when you look at the overnight, you know, from imaginative to just completely bug fuck psychedelic crazy, everything just exploding into, you know, I mean, looks like the same exact kind of thing that ayahuasca shamans did, right? And really where I had the revelation about this is that I watched that program called, what was it, Ancient Astronaut Entheogens, and they talked about how these shamanic artists, you know, they would start off drawing recognizable human figures, but then they draw squiggles and dots and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, going, he's describing Jack Kirby. So, but then, you know, it's too much to describe, but just throughout his career, he just knew things that he shouldn't have known, you know, and predicted things. You know, he did the Face on Mars in 1958. He did a story that was very much like the Stargate sequence in 2001, around the same time. It sat in a shelf, wasn't printed until 2001 was already in production. You know, things like that. I mean, that's like, you know, your double-blind scientific test for a prediction, right? Mm-hmm. All sorts of things like that. But, you know, it wasn't until I learned about how remote viewing was done, what they did, the same exact thing Kirby did. They just sat down in a room with a piece of paper and a pencil and just started sketching. I'm like, oh, okay, now I understand. They were tapped into the same ether, what I call the ether, you know, that Kirby was. And Alex Nino, certainly psychedelic, I don't know how much of his work did that. But, you know, that's really, when you talk about the whole thing with Star Trek, that's what really fascinates me. You know, these episodes of Star Trek that sort of predicted, you know, in a way that nobody else noticed until I sat there and worked it all out. The whole weird story when Jenny O'Connor, who was claimed to be a psychic of the Nine, showed up at Esalen, you know, and somebody who was a board member of the Esalen, you know, did this story that was remarkably like that. I mean, you can say, oh, well, he knew and he had this grand occult master plan. It's like, that doesn't come on, that doesn't hold water, you know? So much of the speculation about intent just doesn't hold water when you really think rationally.
Hey, what do you think about the idea that we're here talking about all of these conspiracies on like a superficial level, you know, covert ops and all of this stuff, and then meanwhile we're simultaneously conspiring to hold together like a projected matrix that's like we've instituted and like through our consensus agreement, like keep in place through like the power of our, you know, determination out of a fear of death and as a coping mechanism. What do you think of that?
I think that's just basic human nature. You know, what else are we going to do?
Right. So it seems like we've been doing this forever. I just wonder if it means that the interface of our relationship to our world is that malleable. That feels like a very positive thing. If we can conspire to hold together this insanity, what could we conspire to hold together in a different way?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been thinking about death lately. I don't know why. But I've been also thinking about, you know, consciousness and energy and how the entire world is a giant energy field, and how our consciousness is energy, and how scientists have just basically thrown the towel in. They don't believe that that consciousness even exists anymore. They refuse to even say what it is. I mean, that's this group of sociopaths called the New Mysterians. I don't know why they call themselves that, but they just basically refuse to say that, acknowledge that consciousness even exists. They say it's an illusion. But, you know, we take these bodily forms, and it's all so improbable. And, you know, we seem to find each other over, you know, spaces of time, you know, even before electronic communication. You know, that's why I'm more interested in older stories and older things before the internet allowed, you know, you just tap into things with a few keystrokes. You know, those are the stories that are more resonant and powerful for me. You know, I've been doing some DNA work on my family, you know, finding out that they were all, you know, genetically of a certain Norwegian tribe that seemed to find each other over time and space. How did that happen? You know, they were not, you know, exoterically identified as such. You know, there are all sorts of mysteries that, you know, when you go to a certain level, you think you explain and you think there are no further mysteries to unravel. And then most people stop there. But really, that's just, you know, that's just sort of the fool's level. You know, the real mysteries just keep unraveling and unraveling, you know, and you just need to do the work. Most people don't want to do the work. Most people are afraid to do the work. I find that a lot of this stuff that we talk about scares people. It really does. Most people are scared by a causality. It threatens them, you know. I think that psychic ability scares people. It scares me. I mean, if people could read each other's minds, I mean, just God, I mean, that would be like prism to the nth degree. I mean, there'd be, you know, people would go insane if they thought that even their thoughts were exposed to the world.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and yet we read each other's minds with every little nuance, right?
A lot of things that we, you know, that you and I and other people are fascinated by scare people. They need to throw up walls of intention and causality so they aren't threatened by them anymore. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I used to like it. Like Krishnamurti would say, you know, people would be like, oh, but this will happen, or that'll happen, like in terms of if they do what he was implying. And he's like, you're already in this hell. What are you talking about? Like, they're afraid of what will come. Yet meanwhile, they don't see that what they're in is so deeply dysfunctional and
well, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. I mean, that's basic human nature too.
Right.
You know? It's true. Most people will sit there and slave away at jobs they hate because they're afraid that maybe the risk will lead to something worse, or maybe it will lead to something better, or, you know, uncertainty is a horrible, horrible reality to some people. And most people will accept, you know, a comforting but incredibly reductionist certainty over a discomforting uncertainty. And that's right. Human nature.
Chris, right. You wrote a really powerful piece, I think about a year ago, about thinking magically and it compelling your audience to be brave in this arena. And I just thought it was concise and direct and important. But I wonder how, if someone doesn't understand what thinking magically is, how do they start thinking magically?
Huh.
Well, you know, you just have to start to, well, you can start by reading those articles, I guess. I mean,
SecretSun.blogspot.
Yeah, I tried to be as instructive as possible, you know, and there were sort of related and supplementary pieces to that. You know, I mean, it's a scary thing, but I think desire is really the linchpin. You know, I mean, it's just a sense of how much do you need to. You know, I don't want to compel people to, you know, what Alan Watts called pull themselves up by their own bootstraps just because, you know, I mean, if you're comfortable where you are, stay where you are, you know, but if you're not, if you feel the call, you know, a lot of people don't feel that call. You know, I'm just trying to, you know, find the others, as the saying goes. You know, I'm just trying to find people who don't fit in, who have a, you know, I sometimes feel like Professor X, you know. I'm just trying to find people who are lost and just offer them a little guidance.
You know, I think that to just sort of the second part of that question is, you know, you wrote about some of the phenomenon attached to the Super Bowls over the last 5 or 6 years. And I always think of the Super Bowl as sort of a national, but now it's sort of almost semi-global. It's really just a ritual designed around alcohol, hot wings, and gambling, essentially. And
yeah, well, you notice the mocking tone again. I mean, if I believe that something is just boring intentional symbolism, I'll usually write in a mocking tone. And when I write about things like the Super Bowl or the Academy Awards, I usually have a very mocking tone because, again, I don't want to be an accomplice to it.
Because that's sort of like a drinking magically kind of event. And we're on the cusp of, you know, legalization of marijuana. And I'm just wondering if we have some sort of cousin to the Super Bowl, where instead of having alcohol as the sacrament, as it were, where it's sort of like a national or semi-global marijuana day,
I'll tell you what, drinking is social, marijuana is more solitary. You know, I think marijuana is
ideally,
more
at least
a personal kind of
ideal,
thing.
Ideally?
I said no. Ideally, at least.
Oh, right. I knew you didn't deal with me.
Yeah.
Just putting it out there.
I marijuana, you know, a lot of times people tend to get paranoid and they're like, you know, what did I just say? You know, everybody's looking at me, you know. I don't know if marijuana really lends itself to a social kind of ritual like that. I mean, who knows, the way it's being engineered now.
But like a critical mass of like a 420 day, where you know probably about 12 to 15% of the population is knowingly or unknowingly taking part in that kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge holiday. But when it's a legal thing and everyone kind of prepares that, oh, what are you doing for 420 this year? When you have a critical mass of people around the world ingesting the same substance, it becomes a sort of ritual, much like the Super Bowl. And I'm just wondering if there would be that whole intentional debacle like the Janet Jackson nipple, or will something emerge out of it that is unintentional just because of the sort of loaded nature of the collective conscious?
Well, you know, marijuana is certainly, you know, I mean, alcohol is like an anesthetic, you know, I mean, it's a depressant. I think whatever occurs, and I never like to make predictions, you know, it's a dangerous game. I will just say whatever arises will probably be a lot more interesting than the Super Bowl. Because, you know, you have more synapses firing because of the THC component there.
Well, I'm sure it'll translate into thousands of hits at your blog spot whenever that day arrives.
Well, we can only hope. I'll tell you something. I have keep trying to. I've been past the point of exhaustion with the blog. I have to confess. There's been several points in time that I've tried to sort of re-engineer it to become a vehicle that is less demanding on me. I have to say that this, well, ironically, I just posted, you know, probably the longest post in the history of the blog, but I had a co-writer. But that Star Trek series I did, which is basically book length, and I basically was doing it while I was working morning, noon, and night on, you know, my freelance work, I really exhausted myself. And I've exhausted myself in the past. I work just as hard to not bombard you with a lot of text. You know, it's hard work being concise. But at the same time, I also a lot, for every paragraph you see, I'm doing a lot of reading, and I mean, I was reading like actual books for that series. I don't know how I got it done. It was just insane, that Star Trek series. I was just like possessed. It was so bizarre. I don't know how that whole thing unrolled.
I also think to the Another History of the Knights Templar, that was just epic. And the amount of detail in that series, I just couldn't believe that I was reading that, you know, for free. It was just top-notch work. And I think I did donate again after that. I think everyone who reads The Secret Sun needs to look in the mirror and should at least donate $20 at some point in their life. But
I appreciate that. I very much do. But again, the Templar thing, I just... Something takes hold of me, like literally possesses me and just like uses me as its vehicle. And it's always like when I'm really busy, because that the same thing happened with that Templar series. I was really busy when I was writing that. But it's punishing. It's brutal. It's physically exhausting. And that's kind of like, I mean, I'm in the middle of another big series now, but like, I think... In the future, I might do more kind of editorial things, because I'm sort of backed up on that end. But a lot of these kind of big research series that you've seen, I can't begin to tell you how much work they are. I mean, more work than you actually see on screen.
I think that's, I mean, it's commendable that you keep doing it. But that's a common thing that I keep noticing. We're in this really interesting time right now, is that people, the good artwork that's being done, or even to produce a show like this, or, you know, takes more work than people realize. To do all the things that we do, there's hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of my day, presumably your day, that go into doing this type of stuff. And it's something that people... maybe ingest in pieces, maybe whatever, and then move on with their lives. Hopefully we've planted a seed, hopefully we've done something. But there's the idea that at the parallel, at the same time, people have gotten so used to not paying for, you know, if they watch a Hollywood movie, they're going to try and torrent it or whatever they're going to do. That people aren't supporting the artists, but they're consuming more media than ever. And you've also written about the idea of pop culture eating itself, that if we're not supporting the artists, I'm just curious, again, not to make a prediction here, but where does that lead us?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'll tell you something. I think that it cheapens it. I mean, and maybe this is just me, but I notice, and I don't download, like I don't torrent or anything like that, but I notice that when I pay for a song on iTunes, I listen to it. Because I go, I paid for this. You know what I mean? It's like, I have an investment in this. I'm going to listen to this because this is something that, you know, I have an investment in, that I put a stake in. And I think the problem with a lot of art today is that it's just becoming this blizzard, this blur of data. But I have to say, I'm not going to sit here and just bash, you know, the downloaders and the pirates and the consumers. I have to say that I really have, you know, you have to put, you know, a lot of the blame on the supply side. I mean, I'll go to the Redbox at the supermarket, and it's like, renting a movie has never been cheaper or easier. and there's nothing I want to see.
Absolutely. Right?
It's all garbage. It's all junk. And I go to the movies, and it's an explosion fest. There's no story. It's a disaster. You know, one of the problems I have with a lot of comic books is that it's like there are five panels of headshots and three word balloons, and like, you know, everything is a 5-minute read. Well, if you're charging $4, you better well give me more than a 5-minute read. It's pathetic. And, you know, up and down the line, you know, you buy a CD I don't buy CDs anymore. But, you know, an album that has two good songs on it. You know, I think that a lot of the sort of antagonistic feeling that people have towards Hollywood and the music industry and so on is not altogether unfounded. I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, junk being put out there. But by the same token, that attitude has bled down to, you know, people, independent people. And, you know, the problem that we have now is that, have you noticed that, like, all the musicians touring who aren't just playing tiny clubs are all, like, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And why is that? Because nobody supports younger artists anymore. Artists come out, put out two albums, and they're gone.
Well, there used to be these scouts, right? And they would go around, and they would look at who's popular in a given area, and they would offer them deals. Now it has absolutely nothing to do with that. There's no one scouting, looking for that special artist now. Those people can go on playing for years and never get noticed beyond their sphere. Like, it's crazy.
Well, you know, it's funny because I read a lot of this stuff back in the old days about, oh, you know, the record company ripped me off and everything. Well, they don't realize that you got signed to a label and you toured in a big, comfortable bus, and you stayed in hotels, and you made videos, you know, you got the ride. Okay, so at the end of the road, you know, you didn't have a lot to show for it, but you had, you know, I think Steve Albini wrote this really interesting article on how many people get paid, you know, from, you know, your $1 million or how many, maybe it was $100,000, I don't even remember, but it was, you know, some band gets assigned to a record company and they get an advance, and how many people get paid from that. And it's like a lot of bands, I bet a lot of the bands that were complaining about that miss that now. You know, they don't realize that they got the ride. They got on MTV and they got interviewed on the radio. And no new bands get that now. None of them. You know, and it's because there's no market to support it. You know, when MTV was playing nothing but rap music back in the, say, mid-2000s, everybody's like, what the hell's going on? Why are they playing nothing but rap music? They played nothing but rap music because that was the only music that people were actually going out and buying.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? Because Everybody, you know, all the people who were listening to indie rock or whatever were just, you know, downloading it on Napster.
You know how many Republicans actually put massive amounts of money into the rap industry? I have a friend who's gone way into that, and that blew my mind. I'm like, really? Like, why? And he's just like, it's because that's what the level that they want to keep things at for certain you know, large chunks of society.
Yeah, that's disturbing to me. That's upsetting to me because that not only is that polarizing, but that is, you know, creating a permanent negative stereotype for people.
What hip-hop and was, came out of the poorest communities and total positivity, people coming together, like, you had a flow going, like, what hit, as hip-hop emerged, how could anyone have predicted rap? It's so anti, it goes against everything. That's why I really like Saul Williams, actually. I like the way that he reflects that and plays with that. I think that's really something, but.
Well, you know, that's a whole other discussion that we'll have to have at another point. But, gentlemen, we are well past the 42nd minute mark here. So
misconception. That's not a problem. We're not 42 minutes. We're always record. So we're anywhere from 1 hour to 6 hours. So you're getting off the hook easy here, Chris.
Yeah, it's true.
Why was I confused? Who's 42 minutes?
42 minutes is Doug and Douglas Bowles and Will Morgan. They're also, we produce their show. So we're like sister radio shows. I know they They did contact you, and then it was funny because when Bill said, "Oh, Chris is ready to come on the show," and I was like, I told Doug that, and he's like, "Oh, we just sent him an invite." He's like, "Well, he'd ignored our invite and took yours, but maybe you thought you were saying yes to them. Now they'll be even more pissed off."
send them my apologies. I thought there was the same show for some reason.
No, we have a different format. We both do dialogue, but we're a little bit looser and more casual, and we're not quite as much of an interview as we are kind of a think tank exploratory kind of thing.
Yeah, this was definitely a different show for us because usually it's just a roundtable conversation on a subject. And this was because you had said you wanted to know some questions in advance, this became a little more interview style, but this is actually a very unusual show for us today.
Awesome.
So.
I thought it was great. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I had a great time.
So okay, thank you so much, Chris.
My apologies. I totally got confused on that. I thought I just zoned out.
But
it's been a rough summer for me. Really, very rough.
Well, I'll extend your apologies to them, but please accept our thanks for joining us today. It's a real pleasure.
I had a good time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we'd like to have you back. Just let us know, man.
Okay, sounds good. All right.
Thanks, man. Have a great day. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.